I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. In the midnight hour of the 22nd of March 2006, the Queen of the North strikes Gill Island, which is 135 kilometers south of Prince Rupert. The boat is carrying 101 passengers and is soon evacuated. The ship's bottom and propellers are ripped out, and in less than an hour it sinks. Two passengers are missing and presumed dead to this day. Shirley Rosette and Gerald Foysey have never been found. A new book, The Queen of the North Disaster, The Captain's Story, sheds some light as to what happened, especially in the aftermath. Joining me now is Colin Henthorne. He was a longtime employee of BC Ferries and was the ship's captain. He wasn't on the bridge at the time of the accident. He was asleep but was quickly awakened and soon directs the evacuation. In the decades since, Karen Bricker, who was on the bridge at the time, was fired, and Carl Ilgert, the ship's fourth mate, was charged with criminal negligence causing death and is serving a sentence of 4 years in prison. Mr. Henthorne recalls the ill-fated voyage as well as highlights the repercussions on him and the crew. Also, he dispels the rumors and innuendo surrounding what happened that night. It's a fascinating book about a modern marine disaster. It also recounts the difficulties Mr. Henthorne faced in the years since, especially the protracted difficulties with BC Ferries. Born in Vancouver, Colin Henthorne has spent all his life living and working on the water. He was a master with BC Ferries starting in 1990. He is currently a Canadian Coast Guard Rescue Coordinator at the Joint Rescue Coordination Centre in Victoria. This new book is from Harbour Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in North Saanich, British Columbia, Colin Henthorne. Mr. Henthorne, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So this book is first of all, it's a terribly engaging book because it puts to rest a lot of speculation that a lot of us have had about the sinking of the Queen of the North, even to what happened to the two people that were never found. I'm assuming addressing a lot of the speculation, a lot of this second guessing that we've all been hearing, doing, that you've heard, obviously. Was that the motivation to write this book?
No, not exactly. I think the motivation partly that, mostly just wanting to put out my story. There are, of course, 101 stories to be told. Mine's just one. And in fact, there are more stories than that because each of those 101 people have others that are in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mostly just to put out my story and to examine possibilities. I want to make it really clear, as I've tried to do, that I don't have all the answers. I don't know exactly what happened, every detail. All I'm trying to do there is discuss possibilities and keep those open. And the other part of the motivation is that it's the duty, I think, of professionals to try to prevent these kinds of accidents from ever happening again. And we can't do that if we don't have everything out that's a possibility, and if we don't dismiss those things that are impossible.
Yeah, so
that's really what I'm motivated to do in the writing
mm-hmm.
of the book.
Mm-hmm. And so you must have heard people who have had heard of what happened, through the media and the sort, and they wonder what the role of the captain is in all of this. That if there are two people missing, that perhaps. The captain should have gone down with the ship, literally and figuratively. How long, as you did leave the ship, you were in a rescue boat. How long after you were lowered into the water did you find out? We're told that there were two people missing.
Well, it was hours afterwards before we were able to determine that.
And so was. Just in terms of say, how a boat is checked as it's being evacuated, I mean, that process, did that fail that night?
Well, it was encumbered by, numerous factors. When emergency procedures are drawn up, We try to think of everything. We try to cover everything, and we depend on things being available to us, such as the people to do the searching,
mm-hmm.
Some of whom were unable to get to their stations immediately, some of whom had to make their own escapes before they could do anything else.
Yeah, there was one person who was injured, I guess, who had trouble getting out of their cabin, right?
Mm-hmm. That's yeah. Right. And then there was the problems of there were some equipment problems. There were some just difficulties with trying to communicate everything and be certain that everything was covered, because we're trying to do two things at once. We're trying to carry out the evacuation at the same time as these searches are going on. There wasn't time to spend in any kind of inefficient way. So the crew did their best they could with what they had and the time they had. It was believed that every cabin was searched at the time. It was believed that the passenger lounges were all cleared out. And the count that I had was 102.
Mm-hmm.
The logbook said 101. I ran through the passenger area just before I left, so I was pretty sure that we had everybody. We tried counting when we were in the boats as the ship was sinking. We had difficulties with that. Ship sank. We still carried on trying to get accurate counts, and that was complicated by the survivors being spread into two different areas. So, everything that I can think of that we could have done was being done. Now, obviously, when I look back on it in hindsight, I try to look at how we could have done things better and how things could have been more efficient. But it's always easy to look back on things in hindsight.
Yeah. When you hear the speculation about what happened to the two who are missing, and it's been 10 years. Do you have any sense of what really happened, perhaps?
Well, no, not really, because the speculation, there isn't a lot of, variety in the ideas of what might have happened to them, only that somehow they were missed. Maybe the cabin was missed, and maybe they didn't hear the alarms or somehow slept through it or were elsewhere in the ship. There's really only a few places that they are likely to have been. They had a cabin rented out. That's the most likely place where I would expect them to be found. They were in the cafeteria up until closing time, which was 11:30.
Mm-hmm.
And the grounding happened at 12:21, according to the best sources that I can gather.
Yeah.
So that's only 51 minutes. That doesn't give you a lot of time to be, so deep asleep or that you would miss out on that kind of noise. The
right.
Alarm bells are extremely loud. There was pounding on doors. There was shouting. There was the commotion of the launch and everything, plus the noise of the impact of the grounding, which woke most people up. So, no, there isn't really anything satisfactory there in the way of speculation. That's really helpful. They didn't have a car, so it's not likely they would have gone down to the car. Extremely unlikely they would have gone to the car deck.
Mm.
And the passenger area's cafeteria was closed.
Yeah.
We only had two seating areas open, and they were all checked. So it is a mystery. I'm sorry that I can't do any better than that. I'm especially sorry that I can't produce the two people. Families,
right. But by the way, on a route like this, do all the passengers have a cabin, or are some, say, sitting in those seating areas and sleeping there, perhaps?
Yeah, it's Some have cabins, some take cabins, some don't. Every voyage there are always people that are sleeping in the passenger areas. We have reclining seats that are very comfortable. Some people will sleep in them. Uh-huh. A lot of people, especially if they're regular travelers, they'll bring a sleeping bag and maybe a mat or something that they find a dark corner. The lights are kept dim, and probably the majority of them sleep in the passenger area.
Yeah. So just after midnight, the ship hits this reef off of Gill Island. At this point, it's after midnight, as you said.
Well, let me correct you there. It didn't hit a reef off of Gill Island. It hit Gill Island.
It hit Gill Island. Pardon me.
Yeah.
So you're in your cabin, your quarters, and you're asleep at this point. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Do you hear the crashes or do you hear the alarms first?
I was the first thing I heard. I was waking up before the ship actually grounded.
Oh, I see.
And it was the helmsman who ran back to my cabin. I'm just a short distance down from the bridge of the ship.
And that's Karen Bricker, right?
That's right. And she pounded on the door and was frantically yelling at me to get up. So it was obvious right from the start that it was an urgent matter. And I got up and got dressed as quickly as I could. But before I got dressed, that's when the ship hit the ground. So I felt the impacts shortly after I got out of bed.
And then they're quite loud,
within
right?
A few seconds. Pretty loud, yeah. It was banging and banging and the ship getting bounced around and leaning over, like anything that was not secured was falling over. I had a few things that I left on my desk because I was expecting a calm voyage, and, you know, those things were sliding onto the deck.
Yeah. So you get to the bridge, and at the time there are two people on duty, one I mentioned already, and then Carl Lilgert, is that right? At that point, I mean, because we find out later the nature of their relationship, and of course there's more speculation about what was happening on the bridge at the time. Did you know what was going on between the two of them in their lives?
No, I didn't know that. This was not my regular crew, mm-hmm. Although I did know both those people and had worked with them in the past over the past several years from time to time on occasion. They were both casual employees. But I didn't know anything about any relationship between them other than work until after the ship sank.
So when you see Mr. Lilgert on the bridge, when you get there from your quarters, mm-hmm. What was he doing? What was he going through?
To be honest, I don't have a clear memory of seeing him when I got up there. I know he was there.
Yeah.
There were other people up there that got there before I did. Mostly, you know, your vision becomes much more focused when you know you're in deep trouble like that. I looked at the radar, was aware that there were other people around me in the wheelhouse. Obviously, I knew who they were, but in my mind, I don't see them in my memory.
Yeah.
Took a look out the window to see what I could learn from that, which wasn't very much. Then I turned my attention to doing the things that had to be done. Lilgert was there. He and the second mate actually made their way, or tried to make their way down to the car deck to check for damage, and they were turned back by the flooding.
Mm.
Then I ordered the anchors to be dropped because at first, I didn't realize that we were not aground. I usually, when a ship goes aground, it stays aground, and one of your big concerns is keeping it from sliding off the reef so it doesn't sink.
Yeah.
So I had the anchors dropped, which did absolutely nothing, of course. And it was Lilgert was one of the two who went down to drop the anchors. He and the second mate.
There's a moment in the book where you have to make a decision as to whether to close the watertight doors below. And in doing so, you could trap somebody inside or crush them to death. That's not the case here, and you don't know that until much later. But what's the physical reaction as you're making a life or death decision like that?
Well, My physical reaction started the moment I went out the door in my cabin. My mouth was so dry when I took the first step out. I was afraid that when I got to the wheel, I said I was not going to be able to speak. I wouldn't be able to give orders or anything. And yeah. I that was the first physical reaction. And then I noticed the pounding of my heart when I looked down. I was looking down to switch on all the deck lights, and I could see my chest wall moving in and out with every beat of my heart. So those were my physical reactions. Oddly enough, my mental state didn't seem to change that much. I seemed to be calm mentally, but my body was ready for the full fight or flight.
Yeah. I mean, reading the book, there's a lesson here about leadership, about how to act in a situation like this. I mean, I guess that's one lesson that comes out of the book for the reader, isn't it?
Yeah, and even, well, for all of us, really, we do drills all the time. We try to think of everything. We do case studies, look at what's happened in other accidents that are known to us, and we study all those, and we try to refine our emergency procedures and expectations as best we can. And so sometimes it's when you have the real thing, you sometimes find a surprise or two that first of all, things actually function as well as they do, and maybe a couple of things that need improvement.
Yeah. So we'll talk about your dealings with BC Ferries after the sinking in a moment. But just in terms of the protocols in place, should a sinking like this occur again? I mean, are you left with much confidence that a similar accident might turn out differently for a BC Ferry?
Well, it could, of course. One of the things I've tried to emphasize during drills and during discussions is for the crew members, all of us, to bear in mind that we only take to these emergency procedures when everything has gone completely wrong. So it's unreasonable to expect that nothing else is going to go wrong once you start your emergency procedure. Things can go wrong with that too, so we have to be prepared for that. And the objective when you do a drill is you try to do it perfectly, and you try to do it perfectly every time, and you try to look for any of the weaknesses. And the reason for trying to do it perfectly is when the real thing strikes, it gives you the best chance of doing at least enough things right that you can save your lives and, we hope, save the ship. So, I can't say that, I'm confident that if it happens again, that it'll go well. Circumstances change all the time. Lots of ships survive groundings. Some ships don't. Some people don't. It can go so many different ways, a million different ways.
So once you get to Hartley Bay, after you're all rescued, you write in the book that Carl Lilgert was in distress. What sort of behavior did you see at that point from him?
Well, mostly his face was just white,
yeah.
And the look on—he just looked like death warmed up. He was—he sat on the floor with his knees up and his head down between his knees, and look of horror on his face, and. As he, tries to come to the understanding of what's happened. I kept him attended the whole time, and people tried to comfort him, but I don't know if they were really able to.
Yeah. So it's 12:21 when the ship strikes, and you're in the rescue boat as you see the ship go down, and it goes straight down. How long did that take from the moment it strikes to when it actually, when I guess it disappears from the surface?
I don't have the exact time. I think it was maybe around an hour, maybe a few minutes more. Just over an hour, I believe. It's a little difficult to get. I could look it up for you what the, what the times that are logged are, but unfortunately, those times are come from the times that they were reported to by some other vessel observing it, the time it takes him to report it to the Coast Guard radio, and the time that took him to report it to the Rescue Coordination Center. Obviously, there are delays in there, so I can't be really pinned down within more than 5 or so minutes.
And so what's it like then Colin, to see this ship that you had worked on for many years, that you were the captain of, go down like this? I mean, this was a boat that you loved, right?
That's right. That's right. It was a ship that I loved, and I, you know, had so much affection and pride in it, and was so, you know, happy whenever I had command of it. It was heartbreaking. I just all I could think of was, oh, my beautiful ship, and I was torn between. I knew that nothing could save it, but that didn't stop me from praying for a miracle, and alternately just hoping that if it was going to sink, just hurry up and get it over with, because it was torture to watch her die like that.
Yeah. And we should note that the rescue, the evacuation, I should say, was carried out by all of you on the crew, that there wasn't another ship that came by and helped out, right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, other ships did, or a couple other vessels did come over, but they didn't actually play any part in the evacuation. It was entirely the crew that did that saved the lives of the 99.
Yeah. So you write in detail in the book about the ordeal with BC Ferries. How long after the sinking are you first fired?
It was in January, so that's 10 months.
Yeah.
Around 10 months.
And then there's a protracted legal battle. You win reinstatement, but then on appeal you're fired again. So one reading your book doesn't feel much confidence about how the corporation is run, certainly not in its handling of you. Was it frustrating to be scapegoated as you were?
Oh, it was frustrating, and especially the extent that they were prepared to go in order to paint me in as bad a light as necessary in order to make that happen.
Yeah, and you write in the book about previous accidents and how crews who were on board at the time were generally dealt with. I mean, it's not the same as to the treatment you got, right?
That's right. I mean, there's a long history there. The people have these ideas. And BC Ferries tried to make the claim, too, that this is what happens. And, in fact, the precedents are simply not there.
Yeah. So do you have any speculation as to why the corporation acted the way they did towards you?
Well, first of all, it made them angry when I was at their inquiry, which they call the divisional inquiry. They asked me about past safety concerns. The question was not germane to the investigation going, and I answered the question honestly, and when I did, there was a marked difference in their attitude. They became irate over that, and that was the beginning of it, as far as I could see. Other people have, you know, speculated about the need for a scapegoat or perceived need for a scapegoat. I don't know. I mean, you're just guessing as to what's in their mind.
Yeah, because at this point they're advertising for your job, and then they're also they hire a PR firm, right?
Well, they hired a PR firm before the sun came up, the day of the sinking. They'd already done that.
Yeah. You write in the book as well about the toll physically and mentally on you. I guess not a day goes by that you don't think of this.
Unfortunately, that's the case. You know, sometime during the day there's going to be a thought towards it. There's going to be a reminder. There's going to be the twinge of pain. sometimes more.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, one of my shipmates once commented afterwards, he says, it's like when you have any kind of wound, it'll scar over, and as the time goes by, the scar will get smaller and smaller, but it's always there. It doesn't go away. The subject comes up in conversation from time to time. People who don't know me, you know, I'll be having a talk with them, and they'll make some reference to the Queen of the North and the sinking. Sometimes people ask me about it, which I don't mind. I don't have any trouble discussing it if they want to know.
Uh-huh. If there was a period of time there where you're having trouble sleeping, and it was around midnight, right?
That's right. It was quite an odd thing. I wasn't expecting that. It was at the point of being ridiculous. I would wake up at the same time every night, and just about around 12:30 in Pacific Standard Time,
mm-hmm.
depending on no matter what time zone I was in, that's when I would wake up, and just around the time that the ship sank, you know, within 10 or 20 minutes of it, maybe half an hour, wasn't exact, but it was always the same, and then I couldn't go back to sleep. It was, and I didn't wake up in a panic, really. I woke up just with my mind going around and around, and not able to get myself back to sleep.
And you try to sleep earlier, but then if you would hear something, it would wake you up, right?
Yeah, slightest sound, if it was sudden, would make me startle. Yeah. Even before I got to sleep, if I just laid down on the bed and there was a sudden noise, it would make me startle, and then I'd have to, you know, try again to go to sleep. And it was comical almost. As soon as I sat up, you could make all the sudden noises as you wanted to. It was just when I lay down, it just kind of showed me how deep the trauma goes. That it just programs your mind to be ready for great danger when the same signs are shown.
Yeah. What sort of work do you do now, Colin?
I have a job with the Coast Guard. I'm a rescue coordinator. I work in the Rescue Coordination Center in Victoria. We do all the search planning for any air and marine searches that go on, and we do all the rescue coordination, do the tasking, decide who's going to go and do what, and for every kind of marine and air distress.
Yeah, and it was a long time for you to find that job, right? I mean, you write about that in the book, just the difficulties in terms of finding employment after the legal stuff with BC Ferries is finished, or you, even when it's ongoing, right?
That's right. That's right. It was very discouraging. I tried to continue in my profession and was frustrated in most of those attempts. I was able to get some casual work. Not enough to pay the bills, really. And even looking at unskilled work outside my profession, I was having trouble trying with that. You know, I was fortunate that I had support from other people in the industry. That's how I got the casual employment, and I was very fortunate that I was able to get the job that I have now.
Yeah. Say, when was the last time you were on a BC ferry?
Oh, I guess a couple months ago, maybe.
Yeah.
I was, living on Vancouver Island now, I have little choice but to ride it once in a while.
Yeah. And what's that like to go back and be there? I mean, does the crew recognize you sometimes?
Very, very seldom do I see anybody I know. Once in a while, it happens. I'm mainly, sailing between Swords Bay and Tsawwassen, I don't know too many people on the out of the Swords Bay terminal, I don't think. I know a few more on the other side. So mostly, no, I go on there. I don't see anybody I know. I'm not recognized. It's just kind of bothers me a bit that I have to be there, but I don't let it get to me.
Yeah. And have you been back up to Hartley Bay or even Gill Island over the last 10 years?
Yeah. When I was hired back, I sailed as captain on the ship that they brought out to replace her.
Mm-hmm.
And made all those runs, did several, did a few months doing that. I was wondering how I would react when I sailed past Gill Island, and to my surprise, I really didn't have an emotional reaction or a physical reaction. It was just another crossing of Wright Sound for me.
Mm-hmm. And do you keep in touch with members of the crew that night and even passengers, say?
Not passengers. Members of the crew as much as I can. It's not all of them. I think, I certainly welcome contact from all of them, but I respect their privacy and their feelings, and if they want to be left alone, then I leave that to them. I try to, be as supportive for everybody as I possibly can be.
Yeah. You mentioned the situation that a few of them have found themselves in over the last 10 years. I mean, there are serious effects to a number of them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the three who lost their jobs. The second mate, Kevin Hilton, lost his job. He had his career pretty much ruined by the whole thing, and there's absolutely no fault to be placed on him. It's just being in the wrong place at the wrong time was the problem there. Some of the crew seemed quite at peace and seemingly unaffected by the trauma. Others are worse traumatized, some of them physically as well as emotionally, and it brings up the point that everyone on board has had a different experience. Mm-hmm. There's no two people had the very same experience. Some of them, were relatively easy compared to the worst, and of course each one of us has a different response to our experiences and a different way of responding. So there's really every variable at play there for everybody.
Now, there was a criminal investigation, and Mr. Lilgert is in prison. Did the criminal investigation and the subsequent trial, did that settle your mind as to what happened that night?
Well, yes and no. I don't think it was. It doesn't sound conclusive to me. Now other people disagree with that. They think it was conclusive. I without really being there in the wheelhouse at the time it happened, you're depending solely on the two people who were. You can take them at their word, or you can decide that they're not being truthful. That's pretty much up to the listener to choose based on what he feels or the other evidence and how it compares. I think there's a number of possibilities, and that the only thing we can do is the only thing I can do is be open to the possibility that there are other explanations, and then what I've tried to do in the book is just discuss what those possibilities might be.
Yeah, and so you're not someone who in the book speculates that they were having sex, Mr.
Well,
Lilger.
That for sure did not happen. There's that is just crazy. That doesn't happen on ships. It's not a place where you have that kind of privacy.
Uh-huh.
People come and go throughout the bridge. It's a place of business. It, and even though much of the coming and going is routine and can be at expected times, people come in unexpectedly all the time. So that's just nonsense.
Yeah.
And it's too bad because what that kind of rumor does, it really makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to really get to the truth of what really did happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Colin, this is it's a well-written book, and I hope for you and those around you, its publication brings you a little more peace than you otherwise had before. Good luck with this book and everything else, Colin.
All right. Thank you very much.
The book is called The Queen of the North Disaster, The Captain's Story. It's from Harbor Publishing. Colin Henthorne joined me on the line from North Saanich in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.